From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, violence in the name of religion. One religious scholar says it's nothing new, nor has it ever been the right way to go.
Everybody has always invoked God in their wars. It's time we get beyond that. If you can make a case for military action, make the case on its own merits, but stop laying it at the feet of God like this is what God wants us to do.
Later, auto contributor Mark Savage talks about the best rides of the past 12 months, including the top of the heap.
And even at 22, you could get like heated seats, heated steering wheel. This is a high-value car, and I think it's just a lot of fun. And, you know, it's a little stylish in my point of view, so that's my car of the year.
You'll just have to wait to find out.
And how a little routine maintenance can prevent the vast majority of roadside car troubles. Lake Effect comes your way next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It does not take long to think of examples of violent acts in the name of religion. Terrorist acts committed by the self-proclaimed Islamic State movement and the African group called Boko Haram are just two recent examples.
But as President Obama pointed out in a speech not long ago, such acts have happened for a long time and they're not confined to Islam. But the president was criticized for raising situations in which Christians had justified violence through their faith.
Charles Kimball watches such discussions with more than casual interest. He's the director of the Religious Studies Program at the University of Oklahoma and author of two books on the subject of religion and violence. He was in Milwaukee recently to speak to students at Marquette University, and he joined us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Nice to be here.
Not long ago, President Obama made reference to violence carried out in the name of religion, referencing, I think it was the Crusades. And this spurred lots of righteous indignation by some in the media and some in the religious world. And as someone who specializes in this field, you must have been watching and thinking, well, here we go again.
Yes, indeed, I was watching. And to be fair to the president, he didn't just reference the Crusades. That was what a lot of people jumped on and said, well, that was 800 years ago and this is now. He made other references to a variety of other ways in which people had invoked Christianity and other religious traditions for that matter. And this is really a focus of one of my books, When Religion Becomes Evil, looking at the ways that people in all traditions, in fact, have justified violent behavior, behavior that's often diametrically opposed to what their religious tradition teaches to justify their actions and behavior. In the case of Christianity, I think the president actually is correct and could have even gone a good deal further. This isn't something in the ancient past. This is something that's plagued the Christian tradition down through the centuries. If you look at the history of anti-Semitism, this is not an old story. This is a 2,000-year-old story, as one rabbi friend put it to me rather pointedly some years ago. He said, you know, 2,000 years of Christian love is almost more than we Jews can bear. Or if you look in the 1990s, we have 20,000 documented cases of rape and murder of Bosnian Muslim women and children at the hands of Serbian Christians. Now, there were atrocities that went in all directions there, so it wasn't one-sided in that sense. But the 1990s is not 800 years ago. Recently, I was talking to a university president who's doing a lot of work on Rwanda, a country that's largely Christian. And he was telling me about the horrors of how these Christians had justified massacres in recent decades in Rwanda. So justifying violence in the name of religion is not something, sadly, that's new. But clearly some of the things that are going on today that get a great deal of attention are coming out of the Middle East, particularly the group ISIS. And it is shocking, and that's obviously part of what they're trying to do, at least the ones who are propagating these videos. They're trying to shock and really draw us in and others in to the conflict and to try and frame it as somehow a conflict between Islam and Christianity or as Islam and Judaism.
Well, and when you talk about violence in the name of religion, it seems the key here is the phrase in the name of. You don't call it religious violence.
Right. Exactly. It's religion often becomes the justification for conflict. a lot of conflicts are economically based or land based or some other. It's not because of religion, but they often devolve very quickly into an us versus them and religiously justified conflict. When your son or daughter or your children are dying in war, you know, it's not enough to say, well, we need the oil somewhere, but rather it becomes a great cause and people invoke God. This is a great cause and God is on our side. We see this throughout the centuries. In my book, When Religion Becomes Evil, I have a chapter on declaring holy war and largely try to make the point that everybody has always invoked God in their wars. It's time we get beyond that. If you can make a case for military action, make the case on its own merits, but stop laying it at the feet of God like this is what God wants us to do. We should have learned by now. I think it was Abraham Lincoln who had the famous line, which is still quite pertinent today and rare among political figures, who said, the question is not whether we are, you know, God is on our side. The question is, you know, are we on God's side? A much more humble and obviously helpful way to look at things rather than just assuming God is in our pocket.
Well, and when we think of Christianity or Judaism or Islam, these are all faiths that purport to follow the Ten Commandments as part of their religious teachings. So why is, if you will, thou shalt not kill such a selective part of people's approach to this?
Well, I would say particularly in the case of Christianity and Islam, the history of Judaism is far less. Obviously, there are elements in the Hebrew Bible, ancient Israel, and there are some dimensions related to the state of Israel today in conflict where one could make some arguments about that. But for the most part, Jews have not been – historically have not been in political power. And that seems to be a big key. When religion is connected to political power, people find ways to justify whatever means necessary to stay in power. One of the challenges I think is that – and this is a human tendency that most of us fall into whether we intend to or not, and that is – we tend to think of our own religion in terms of its ideal and everybody else in terms of the flawed lived reality that we see around us. So we hear Muslims continually say Islam is a religion of peace. Islam means peace. Well, that literally is what the term means. That's the meaning of the word Islam. It's submitting to the will of God, and that implies and involves being at peace in the world. A Muslim is one who submits to God, one who is at peace. But when you see the behavior of violent extremists invoking Islam, it hardly looks like a religion of peace. Similarly, when you look at the history of Christianity, and this was, I think, part of the point that the president made, however well, however clumsily, at the presidential prayer breakfast, you heard Christians say, well, Jesus taught a gospel of love. I think that's true. I'm actually an ordained Baptist minister. I do believe Jesus taught a gospel of love. But when you look at the behavior of Christians historically in terms of just war and certainly crusade or inquisitions or the treatment of slaves in America, you can go down the list, there's a whole lot that doesn't look very much like a gospel of love. So how do people justify that? And clearly they find ways to do it.
And to that degree, when someone, whatever their faith is, sees these kinds of violent acts perpetrated and hears the people perpetrating those violent acts as doing it in the name of God or in the name of their faith, how do we begin to unpack that and say, well, you might say this, but I don't believe you?
Right. Well, I mean, clearly actions speak louder than words. It's easy enough to mouth Jesus taught a gospel of love. But again, if you happen to be Jewish throughout much of the last 2,000 years, it didn't feel much like that. And so that's part of it. The other is I think, and this is a big key, it involves education and helping or whatever efforts we can pursue to humanize the other. The vast, vast majority of Muslims all over the world, 1.5, 1.6 billion people who self-identify as Muslims, are not violent. They're not extremists. They're doing what everybody else is doing. They're trying to get their kids fed and off to work and off to school and getting to a dentist appointment and grandmother's birthday party tonight and fixing a flat tire and doing things like that. What we tend to see, of course, or the media will gravitate towards what is most dramatic and most sensational, of course. And so if you don't know much about Islam, you don't know Muslims personally, then if you keep seeing these things on television and so forth, and they are happening, they're real, that tends to give you an impression that this is somehow what Islam is all about. The more you know about the history of Islam, the more you know Muslim people, the more that image breaks down and you see this is part of the reality, but it is only a part of the reality. Same way with Christianity. If you were living in Bangladesh, let's say, and knew nothing really about Christianity, but you kept seeing on TV stories about torture at Abu Ghraib and people flushing Qurans down the toilet in Guantanamo and a Florida pastor who wants to burn Qurans on 9/11, or stories about, you know, massacres of Bosnian women and children, Muslim women and children in the former Yugoslavia, you know, what would be your image of Christianity? You'd think these people were crazy and violent and vile. Now, if you're a Christian in the United States, let's say, and you see all these things, or Westboro Baptist Church, or go on down the list, you know, you see that and you see that doesn't represent the way the vast majority of Christians believe and live out their faith. This has nothing to do with Pope Francis. This is not Mother Teresa. This is not Billy Graham. So we know enough about our own tradition – I speak now from that tradition – to see these things on the extreme as part of the picture but not representative of what the vast majority of Christians believe and how they practice. So we need a lot more in the way of education about Islam and a lot more humanizing of the other, so we're not seeing Islam through the lens of a kind of monolithic stereotype that somehow is violent and menacing and coming at us.
Do we need to be less defensive about our own faith? I mean, I wonder if some of the defensiveness about the things that President Obama said came because people saw a critique of Christianity as a critique of them.
Sure. No, I think that's precisely – and that comes back to my point that the tendency is to think of one's own religious tradition in terms of the stated ideal as opposed to the flawed lived reality. And so when somebody like Fred Phelps, the late Fred Phelps at Westboro Baptist Church, is behaving badly, most Christians won't look at that and say, well, there's a fine example of Christianity. They'd say, you know, this guy is – you know, he thinks he's behaving like a Christian, but most of us just find this vile, what he's doing. When you point out, as the president was doing, that, you know, Christians and others should be slow to point their finger at people around the world for justifying violence in the name of religion, that hits closer to home. And that's part of what, you know, I try to do is to say, you know, look, there's a larger phenomenon here, and that really is especially in the When the Religion Becomes Evil book, what I'm looking at is take a step back. Let's look across the traditions and through the centuries, and I believe we can identify some patterns now that we see happening in the Buddhist and the Christian and the Muslim and the Hindu and to some extent in the Jewish community as well, where people fall into these patterns of justifying behavior that is really opposed to what their religious tradition is supposed to be about.
You do your work in an academic setting, and as we're having this conversation, you're getting ready to speak at Marquette. What are the kinds of questions and issues that the younger generation brings up when they speak with you?
Well, I think the particularly questions related to Islam, the most common questions relate to, you know, is it true what I keep seeing in these emails or hearing about Islam is somehow Muslims are told to go kill the Christians and Jews. That's what the Quran teaches. Or somehow that all women are mistreated in Islam and subjugated in some way. So there are questions about gender and Islam. Sharia law. There's a lot of confusion about Sharia law. And I'm from Oklahoma where we were the first state to have a statewide referendum that passed by 70% banning Sharia law. I've actually been doing a study for the last four years, and I've talked to over 100 clergy. I've yet to find one who could even define what Sharia law is. But they're certain it's coming at us and it's going to get us. And when I say, well, what is it you're afraid of? Well, you know, Sharia. Well, what is Sharia? What is your concern? Well, they don't even know. It's just they're convinced it's dangerous and here it comes. So addressing those sort of questions, these sort of stereotypes are the kinds of things that come up. A lot of people keep asking, you know, why don't we hear more Muslims stand up and speak out against violence and extremism? And there's been a tremendous amount of that. It doesn't get the same kind of media coverage as somebody blowing something up. But I keep saying to my Muslim friends, you know, I know you're doing a lot. You need to keep doing more. You need to find more ways to be visibly opposing. And I would say to Christians and others, we need to be finding more ways to be visibly speaking up against people who are calling for violence and behaving in ways that don't seem to be very Christ-like, in our own tradition. So let's not just look at the other, but look at ourselves in the process.
Well, Charles Kimball, it is an important conversation to have. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mitch.
Charles Kimball is director of the Religious Studies Program at the University of Oklahoma. He's also an ordained Baptist minister and the author of the books When Religion Becomes Lethal and When Religion Becomes Evil, on the intersection of violence and religion. He was in Milwaukee recently to speak with students at Marquette University.
We'll shift gears and talk about cars, the best of the past 12 months, in fact, with auto contributor Mark Savage when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If the sudden onslaught of spring-like weather has you ready to hop in your car and get out onto the open road, good for you. And if you have a convertible or maybe a sunroof, so much the better. The Lake Effect team is looking forward to the feel of a nice warm breeze blowing through our hair on a back road this spring.
Well, at least those of us with hair are looking forward to that.
Hey.
Anyway, to put us in the mood, Lake Effect auto contributor Mark Savage joins Dan Harmon to share his Zoomy Awards, his list of the best of the past 12 months, starting with the award for the most fun car to drive.
The most fun car I drove all year was the Jaguar F-Type, which was a Roadster. They do have a coupe now available, so, you know, you have a couple choices. But, you know, this is a $90-some-thousand-dollar car, as I drove it anyway. And with a big 495-horse V8 in it. But it's a cute little roadster. So, you know, it's nice if you've got a car like that in the summertime to drop the top and barrel up the highway entry ramps or down the highway entry ramps, as the case may be. And, you know, it's impractical in many, many, many ways. But if you've got the money and you've got the, you know, resources to keep that thing going, then it's awesome. And what I thought was really fantastic about it is this was the best, I think, sounding car that I've driven for quite a while. It even had a program in it that you know, punch a couple buttons and it makes it sound even racier. And, hey, if you're a car guy, that's what you like.
All right. And I was in that car with you, and fun, certainly it is, for a lot of money. Do you have a runner-up? Like, what would be a good substitute for, like, a Mustang convertible,
something like that would be good. I mean, if you're still wanting to spend a fair amount of money, the Corvettes are now, mm-hmm. you know, $60,000 to $70,000 if you got them all souped up, and depending on which version you got. And that's a very nice car too, and actually very comfortable. And the Jag was very comfortable, I thought, for what it is. And mm-hmm. you know, there's a big difference between something like a Mazda Miata that you may be spending $25,000 to $35,000 on, and it's cute and it's sporty and it's fun, versus something like this that has a major V8 in it and lots of power and all the little extra features that you would expect at that price.
All right. So what made this fun then? Was it the way it looks, the way it made you feel, the performance, all of the above?
All of the above. I mean, it looks great. I mean, I think this is one of those cars that when people see it, they go, ooh, wow, look at that. So it is a good-looking car, very smooth, very, well, I would call them sexy for lack of any other word. And it's a convertible, so that makes it fun too. And the engine just means that you've got the performance to back up the looks.
Well, let's just keep in the sporty category, if you will. What's your best sports car of this past year?
Well, what I call it was my best sporty car, and I know people will probably question me on this one because it had the Scion TC, and it's a pretty inexpensive car, but it drives nice. It's a fun car to drive, and I think it's a sporty-looking car and a little different than most sports cars. This has a little flatter roof line and back end to it. So it looks just a little bit different. I love what I consider my second choice was the Subaru BRZ. I think it's the best-looking new sports car, sporty car out there. But what I liked about the Scion is that it wasn't expensive. You know, you're talking $20,000-some, depending on what all you put on the thing. But it has a very interesting experience, a very interesting appearance to it. Kind of reminds me of the old Celicas that were sporty, cute, fun. just enough horsepower to make them fun, light and lively handling, so it's easy to handle and, you know, you don't feel like you're fighting the steering wheel, quick to change lanes, all that sort of thing. And, you know, if you can get that and still have a few dollars left in the bank, then that makes it fun.
And does that count as your favorite sporty car, or is there another category for a sport coupe?
Well, I do have a sport coupe. And, you know, what I'm saying in the story this year is, you know, if you read any kind of car magazines, The Car and Driver, The Road and Track, you know that everybody loves BMWs. And I think if you're going to name a car of the year, one of those magazines is going to name a BMW as car of the year 99% of the time. Well, this year I agree with them. I had the 428i. It's their new 4 series, so they're kind of – it's really a 3 series, but they're moving up now calling it a 4 series, I think. And it's the right size car to be a good handling car. And I've never been a real giant fan of BMW's ride, but they have got this thing nailed. It is – you know, our roads crumble around here because of the winters, and you can take this down one of our bumpy roads and – well, of course, you'll notice that there's bumps. It's not something that's going to punish you. And so many times the BMWs and Mercedes and Volkswagens in particular have very, very punishing rides. And they've all been moderating that over the last 10 years or so. But I think that now BMW has it absolutely nailed with this. This was the best handling, riding, driving car probably I've ever driven.
Wow. And that's saying a lot.
And it's saying a lot. And is it? You know, is it a cheap car? Of course not, because it's a BMW. But this was between $42,000 and $50,000, and in today's market, I know those of us who don't spend $42,000 to $50,000 on a car will say, "Oh my gosh, that's a lot of money." But really, that's a modest luxury car at this point.
All right, and that's your best sports coupe.
My best
of the year.
Sports coupe, right?
Okay. And that makes me wonder. We've talked about this before, but. Why is it that we want such firm riding cars in a part of the world where that just doesn't make sense?
Well,
both because roads are terrible and B, there's nowhere to really do it. You know, there's not any place where you can drive it A, fast, and B, roads that are actually purpose built for having fun. You know,
right? We need an autobahn. We need an autobahn between here and Minneapolis or something. You know, and
or even just beautiful mountain roads. You know, yeah. We don't have that around here.
True. Yeah, I ain't going to Holy
US.
Hill when it's kind of fun to drive around that area, but. Again, we don't get a choice because they're going to design these cars for the Autobahn because the BMWs are definitely going to be designed for that. But we get a stiff suspension because that makes the car more responsive, and more responsive says sporty.
But not even just German cars. It seems like it's a selling point. Firm ride.
Yes, firm ride. Well, the older some of us get too, the less firm we like it to be. And as I say, we get to our Buick stage of life where it's kind of nice to have some soft leather seats and a very kind of an air suspension in there.
But even some of those are firm.
Well, yes. Yeah. But more and more, like the BMW, they have an adjustable suspension system so you can firm it up and make it really firm if you're going to – even if you're lucky enough to run up to Road America for a weekend or something. But you also have a comfort setting or touring setting frequently that you can put it in that softens it up just a bit. And for the BMW, it does a perfect job, whereas some of the others, it helps, but maybe you're not quite there. I like the Cadillac, this ATS, the new one that came out. It's coupe, and that's – I give it my second place award. And any other year, it probably would have won. But its ride is still not as refined and as nice as that in the BMW, at least to my feel anyway.
What is your best family car?
Best family car this year I have is my Subaru Legacy, and a couple of reasons for that. One is it's basically around $30,000 for an all-wheel drive car. So in our climate, that's nice to have. It's something that you know, you may think you're going to have to pay a lot extra for, but it's not dramatically higher price for that. It's a bigger car than it has been. They keep stretching it a little bit here and there, and the ride is really comfortable in this. So if you're taking 4 or 5 people and you're driving cross-country in it, it's going to be a comfortable car, good-sized trunk, all that sort of stuff. Plus, the model I had the 3.6-liter boxer 6 engine in it, and that has 256 horsepower. So while everything is relative as to how racy something is, because this is a fairly substantial car, it feels like you got a little power there. And boy, you can, you know, have a little fun getting on the freeway. And say, all the cars are pretty nice anymore. Most of them ride decent, but you want to have that little bit of an edge, something that the other cars don't. So with the all-wheel drive, a little bit more power, comfortable ride, I feel like that's a especially nice car for this part of the world.
Okay. Well, best hybrid.
The best hybrid. Well, I got, I guess, two because I don't just drive cars. I drive a lot of sport utilities and so forth too. But what I called my family hybrid sedan this year is the Kia Optima. You know, a good size, mid-size car. I think it's one of the more attractive mid-size cars out there. So that gives it a plus in my mind because my Zumi Awards, they always like to have a little bit of style to these things too. I just don't want to go for every square boxy thing that's out there. And I got 39.5 miles per gallon in this driving on the freeway. I got a little bit less when I was just driving around town, but it is a dandy of a car, and I think it was around $32,000, $33,000. So you're thinking I'm going to get the size to hold the whole family. I have a little bit of styling that so it looks pretty good. I've got the hybrid system, so I'm getting the super gas mileage, a big trunk, and it was a very quiet car. In fact, I remember riding at the time that you probably would feel like you're in a $45,000, $50,000 car just from the ride quality and the quietness of the interior. So you know, what's wrong with that? If I'm going to get a hybrid and I want to take the family with me on that, that's, you know, a primo choice anyway. And then on the other side, the crossover end of things, I really liked the Toyota Highlander this year. Again, it's a little pricier. You're going to pay closer to $45,000 to $50,000 for something like that. But I was impressed at both the – just the quiet, smooth feel of the whole thing and how the system worked. It – you know, wasn't as clunky as some, or maybe clunky is a bad word, but a little less hesitation and a little more
– more seamless.
Yeah, a little more seamless and a little more low-end torque. And that's what you usually need on a car is to just kind of get it up and running. Is most of us, it probably doesn't matter so much between, you know, 30 to 40 mile an hour how much power it has there because you're just kind of slowly accelerating on. But when you're pulling away from a stoplight, you like to feel like if I need to move a little faster, then I've got that power there. And both the Kia and the I call it the Kia Pepe, the Highlander is another one that, like I say, is just it's just a fun car to drive and has a little oomph to it.
Okay. And how about SUV? What's your best SUV? And just as a to explain, I mean, these are cars you've driven. These aren't necessarily your pick cars of
right.
All
I don't,
cars
I don't pick them over the last 5 years
yeah.
of which one was the best because, you know, I get on average 50 cars a year. And yeah, I can only judge those for what was the best this year anyway. So I didn't drive every single thing that's out there. But I did have the new Hyundai Santa Fe Sport. And it is, again, a very nice blend of kind of an entry-level luxury car with a sport utility. So you have the four-wheel drive available to you, super handling, attractive overall styling. I think a number of the sport utilities, they've actually worked on getting them to look at least a little different. Of course, I guess if they all start looking the same a little different with a little more of a swept-back look to it, which is what the Highlander and then this Santa Fe have. And the Santa Fe Sport is a little bit shorter version of it, so that's why it handles a little bit better. But you still have plenty of room for a family of, you know, four or five people in there. And it has good power, too. Most of these start off with a 2-liter turbocharged engine. This one has 264 horsepower. So anything over about 240 horsepower usually makes these things move pretty quickly. And it also had a second row seat that you can kind of slide forward and back and give it a little more, you know, leg room for the people if you don't have a lot of cargo in the back. Or you can scoot it forward and throw a little bit more cargo.
Okay. And I'm going to throw a surprise category at you.
Okay.
Which may require you to step outside of the cars you've driven. I don't know. But what is your opinion anyway? Because you probably haven't driven. But what's the best electric car right now you think you can get? What impresses you the most from the past year?
Well, the electric car that I've driven the most and enjoyed the most is the Chevy Volt. You know, and it has the backup gas generator. I mean, it's always running on electric power basically, but it has that backup generator. So you don't have to worry about your distance, you know, and how far I can go. You can drive to Chicago and back, Madison and back, whatever, and not have to worry about it. And it's a well-built car. It feels like a little, you know, kind of smaller luxury car, and it is seamless. You know, say it drives very, very nice, and, you know, you get the first somewhere between 40 and 50 miles of basic electric power, and so there you're saving gas right there, especially if you're just driving back and forth to the to work most days. But if you're driving even to Madison or something like that, most of the way there you're on electric power, and by the time you get there, the gas engine kicks in and powers up the batteries, and away you go. The Nissan Leaf was a fun little car to drive, but they had to bring it to me on a truck, and they had to take it away on a truck because it only will go, maybe 50 miles. Like I say, great around town, but and I always wonder too if you have to plug in your electric car and you live in a city atmosphere where maybe you have to park on the street. I'm thinking, is somebody going to mess with that? So first of all, somebody could just come unplug it on you. Now, you thought you charged your car overnight, you come out and it doesn't have a charge. Or with all the snow and stuff we have, is that going to be a problem? Is somebody going to trip over it because you got your cord running from your porch out to your car in front of your house? And what if you got to park so far away from your house, you can't plug the car in? So there are issues certainly with that sort of thing. I think anything with either a hybrid system or like the Volt where you have a backup gas power plant to help power up the batteries is probably the way to go, at least for now, unless you live in the suburbs and you got a garage and you can plug it in every night.
And Volt has the kind of the next gen Volt is coming out.
Right. The next gen Volt is coming out, and then they have something called the Bolt with a B.
A few years down the road.
It'll be a couple of years down the road. So we'll see. All that technology is still relatively new, and so it's being developed fairly quickly. And there's always going to be a change every year or two until we get to the point where they're selling more and people like the technology they have, and they won't have to push it quite as hard.
All right. And the Bolt supposedly, ostensibly, will have a 200-mile range on the charge.
That's what they're saying. And if that's the case, then now you've opened it up a lot. And, I know we've talked about Teslas here in the past, and I'm sure those are delightful, but I haven't gotten to drive one yet. So, hey, if Tesla wants me to talk about how wonderful those electric cars are, maybe they need to get me one to drive.
All right. Okay. And your last category is the car of the year. I don't know what it is, so lay it on me.
The car of the year, and again, I'll probably take some heat on this one. Yeah, I got the Kia Soul, and I like the styling of this thing. And I know a lot of guys are going to say that's a chick car, and you do see a lot of women driving the Soul, but it's a very practical car, but I think it's kind of cute. I like the roof line. I like it how it kind of slopes to the back. I drove the Kia Soul Plus, which is one up basically from the base model. So it has a little bit larger 2-liter engine in it, so it's like 164 horsepower. I think the base engine's like 130. So that gives you just enough power to make it kind of fun to drive. Again, a light handling car, easy to handle, easy to park. You got a ton of space in the back. You can push the seats back or push the seats down and put a bunch of stuff in the back. I think this would be a great delivery vehicle for a small business too. They've got an electric version now. I haven't driven that one yet, so I'll be curious how that goes. And at the Chicago show, they showed off an all-wheel drive version that they're calling a concept. But I'm pretty sure that, in the next year to two at the most, you'll probably see an all-wheel drive version. So what's not to like? It's got a cool interior on it, very young, youthful look to the thing, and everything's easy to get at. The buttons you can see, you can press, you can read everything. Gee, if we can do that for 19 grand, which is what the Soul Plus started at, and I think we had added a few options to maybe got to 22 or 24. And even at 22, you could get heated seats, heated steering wheel. This is a high-value car, and I think it's just a lot of fun, and it's a little stylish in my point of view. So that's my car of the year. Go ahead and argue with me if you guys want.
Nope. I will not argue with you. All right. Well, thank you again, Mark, for coming in.
No problem. Had a good time.
Mark Savage writes about cars on his website in a column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's also associate publisher for four magazines at Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing, American Snowmobiler, Classic Toy Trains, Fine Scale Modeler, and Scale Auto Magazine. He's our regular auto contributor, and he spoke with Dan Harmon about his annual Zumi award list.
Even a good car can run into trouble on the road, a flat tire, say. What then? How prepared are you for roadside troubles? Hopefully a bit more prepared after our next segment as Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we heard auto contributor Mark Savage's annual Zoomy Awards, food for thought as you think about whether a new car might be in your future.
But regardless of whether you're thinking about a new car, you're probably wanting to make sure you have a tire gauge after you hear from Walt Brinker. Since Brinker's retirement from a military career, he's developed an active hobby, roadside assists.
Brinker, who lives in North Carolina, estimates he's helped more than 2,000 stranded motorists for free. That hobby has spawned a book called Roadside Survival, and when Walt Brinker reached out to us, it seemed like an ideal topic for anyone planning to do a little driving. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's great to be here.
I want to start with a point you make fairly early on in this book, and that is there are two types of people in the world, those who have been stranded on the road because of car trouble and people who will be. Do you think we should view problems as an inevitability?
Well, I believe that you can prevent a lot of bad things from happening to you. I believe that you make almost all of your own luck, good or bad. About 5% is fate, and the other 95% you can influence. But I really believe that there are two kinds of drivers, those who have experienced a disabled vehicle and will again, and those who will for the first time. It's not a matter of whether, it's a matter of when you're going to do it, because there's so many variables out there that can come along and ruin your day. And the trick is to be able to prevent the majority of them by doing common sense things up front as a preparation, and then to be prepared to contend with the circumstance that finds you disabled, to prevent yourself from being stranded. Stranded means you can't help yourself, you're just out there.
Right, and the idea here is that you can greatly reduce your risk of being stranded by following
these
preventive steps.
Exactly.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the issues that you coach people through and how they might be prevented as well. You write that tire issues constitute really the vast majority of the problems you encounter.
I would say, having done this a lot now, some 2,000 free-of-charge roadside assists I've done as a hobby, I would say easily three-quarters of the people I stop for and I'm able to assist have tire-related issues. They've had a flat tire, the tread has come off, the tire is just flat, and they can prevent this so many ways. The most fundamental thing to prevent yourself from breaking down for all reasons is to take care of your tires on your car, the ones that are the four tires on the ground, or maybe six tires if you have dualies in the back, or if you have a trailer to make sure those tires are in good shape, or a camper, same thing.
Well, and so when you say take care of, what are the kinds of things that you should be checking?
I'm talking about, first off, buying new tires, good tires in the first place. Don't buy used tires, because you're buying someone's time bomb with a set of used tires, generally. When you get a set of new tires, normally you can take the option of getting a quote-unquote free replacement for a damaged tire. I always take that option. Pays a little bit more up front, but I found that almost every time I bought a set of four tires, before that set of tires wore out, one of them got damaged by hitting a pothole, by hitting a curb or something, some reason that it got destroyed or could not be repaired, such as a damage to the sidewall. They can repair a lot of damages, a lot of holes in the tread, but if the sidewall gets cut or gets punctured by a nail or some debris in the highway, they're not safe to repair, and so they cannot be repaired. Develop a habit of every time you get in your car, just look at your tires, see if they're low, obviously. You can't always tell if a tire's low with low-profile tires, so about once a month I advocate using a tire pressure gauge on the tires just to check them. Certainly before you go on a long trip, check the tires for pressure.
One of the issues that we encounter, especially in a cold climate like Wisconsin, is changing tire pressure depending on the temperature. What are the rules of thumb that you write about for understanding how our tire pressure is impacted by swings of 5 or 10 degrees in air pressure, or in temperature, rather?
Well, the rule of thumb for that, and this is when tires are cold now, which is when they ought to be checked, is for every fluctuation of 10 degrees Fahrenheit, up or down, the PSI in the tire will change. The warmer the temperature, the higher the PSI. The lower the temperature, the lower the PSI. So if the temperature goes from 80 degrees Fahrenheit to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, that's a loss of 30 degrees Fahrenheit, which works out to a loss of about 3 pounds per square inch due to nothing more than ambient temperature outside your tire.
Now, does this lead to an issue? You know, let's say that you go out in the morning and it's a really cold morning. It was 3 degrees in parts of the Milwaukee area this morning. Your tire pressure is low. You add air to the tire. Do you run into problems when the temperature warms up?
Well, you have to be reasonable about that. Warms up how much? It's not going to warm up that much, probably. if it's 3 degrees in the morning, it's probably not going to get much more higher than maybe 20 more degrees during the day. I would let that ride. But I would want to be sure that I was covered against underinflation, because underinflation is the root cause of an awful lot of tire problems. That's the root cause of a lot of blowouts, that's the final symptom before the blowout occurs, because in an underinflated state, the sidewall flexes too much and too extensively and finally wears out. And that's what causes most blowouts.
So you talk about tire pressure. What are the kinds of other things we ought to be looking at on a routine basis on our tires?
Just give your tires a look for any damage or any issues with the sidewalls. If you see any cuts in the sidewall, you're on borrowed time with a cut on the sidewall. Of course, if your tire's low, don't even think about going out and driving on it. If the tire's low, I always advocate keeping a tire pump, an air pump, a 12-volt compressor in your car so you can always tune up your tires to get, as a minimum, to the tire store to get the tire fixed. Now, some folks, when they have a flat tire, they'll just, if it's a nail, you can do it. You can fix a nail flat tire sometimes with a plug job by putting a plug in it. You can buy the plug kit at Walmart for $10 or so. However, the only thing with that is you've got to get access, and that only works on the tread, not on the sidewall, because you cannot repair a sidewall. But to make the plug solution work, you only have to get the tire off the car and then determine where the nail is if you can't see it readily. And I use a little squirt bottle full of soapy water for that. Of course, you have to put some air in the tire first, mm-hmm. squirt some air in there with your tire pressure, with your pump, and then see where the air is escaping by looking for bubbles, for soap bubbles. And that is where the hole will be. Then you pull that nail or screw out with a pair of pliers and then work the plug and then repump it up, of course. But the problem I find that most of my customers are out on the interstate or on the highway, and by the time the tires have gone flat, the car has run with its rim directly on the sidewall until they can stop the car. And doing that tends to ruin the sidewall and makes the tire unsafe to drive on. And so then it's time for the spare tire to come out.
And then you advocate for paying close attention to the spare tire, which is something that I imagine a lot of people aren't looking at until they need it.
Mitch, I'll tell you, 80%, fully 80% of the people that I encounter out there with a flat tire have a spare tire that is either flat or has far too little air in it to be useful. Most spare tires these days, or many of them anymore, are donuts. They require 60 PSI to be effective. They got to be really, really hard. And the sidewall can feel strong and can feel hard to the touch. And I have many people, I ask the question, do you have air in that spare tire? And they'll thump it with the palm of their hand and say, yep, good to go. And I'll say, well, let's just put the gauge on it to see. Well, the gauge does not lie. When the gauge goes on there, 80% of the time the spare tire is too low to use. It's incredible.
Let me ask a dumb question, or potentially a dumb question. You can test the air pressure and potentially refill the spare tire with air without necessarily taking it out of its cradle, or do you have to take it out?
You can. It depends how the spare tire is stowed. Now, many times, though, the way it's stowed is the valve valve to put air pressure in is frequently stowed the wrong way, so you don't have access to it. If you can influence that, for sure, to flip it around and have the valve facing on a pickup truck or a van where it's under the back of the vehicle, have that part down so you can, if you have to, you can crawl under the vehicle and check it that way. Or if the spare tire is in your trunk, you can have the spare tire sitting there so that the valve is up and not down, in other words, in view and not hidden by being on the floor side.
Another point we ought to make is that you advocate making sure that if you do have a flat and you go to repair it, you do it in a safe location. And sometimes that means, out of necessity, having to drive on a flat tire until you can find a safe place to pull off, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're on a highway and there's no shoulder, like let's say you're on a bridge and there's no shoulder on that bridge because the bridge has to be narrower. Yeah, I mean, you can't stop it. To stop in the drive lane is foolish. That's very dangerous. And so you want to just keep on going and keep driving slowly with your blinkers on, staying in the right lane, of course. And the first time you find a place you can pull off safely and get out of the drive lane, do it. And then you can either have the car sit there and try and call for help to pull you out of there, or you can go into the self-help mode and save yourself.
If tires and tire issues represent the majority of the issues that you see in your time patrolling the roads around your where you live, you also write that that people simply running out of gas also represent a fairly substantial number, and that seems like one of those very easily preventable issues. But sometimes there are complicating factors, gas gauges that don't work, or other problems.
You're right, right on, Mitch. 25% of the people, I told you, three-quarters of the people I stopped for are tire issues. The other 25% are a combination of running out of gas, being locked out of your car, the car overheats, or the car just shuts off, generally because of an electrical issue, which is normally solved by tightening up the battery clamps. But yeah, out of gas is one of those things that's totally preventable if you're paying attention. Now, if your gas gauge is broken, then you need to realize that it's broken and not get it fixed. That's the first thing you should do. I mean, if you're putting that off for any reason, for hopefully a good reason, that you can do it soon. But meantime, you can have some kind of control over how far you have to go by every time you top off the car, push the trip odometer, and of course, hopefully you figured out or do this shortly after it goes flat. When the gauge doesn't work anymore, you know about how many gallons you have used when you top the car off, and you figure out how many you used at the next top off, and divide that by the number of miles, and figure out your miles per gallon. So that's a temporary solution until you get the gauge fixed. But there are many. I advocate carrying an empty 1 gallon can, one gallon gas can in your trunk. So if you do run out of gas, that you can either walk to a station and get more gas, or have a good Samaritan or even a highway patrolman come by and take that gas can, go to the station, and bring it back to you, and you can put it in your car. Now, there are other things that pop in once you put the gas back in your car. Typically, when you're on a highway and you run out of gas, you're on the level. The car's level. When you pull onto a shoulder, often the shoulders slope to the right. So you pull off the shoulder, and the right tires then are lower than the left tires many times. When that happens, you add the gallon of gas to your tank, and the gallon that you add tends to pool in one corner of the gas tank and does not right away get to the intake, to the engine, from the gas tank. And so what I do is I add the gallon of gas, tell them to crank it, and if it doesn't start, then what I've done is I've opened the right passenger door, I'll stand on the floorboard, and while the driver's turning the engine over, I'll jump up and down or cause the car to rock. I call that rock the car. And that causes the gasoline in the engine or in the gas tank to slosh around and find the intake, and then the engine starts. I've done that at least 30, 35 times, and every time the driver's just amazed, like it's pure magic, you know.
When did helping people with car trouble go from something you were capable of to something that you actively pursued as a hobby?
I think it all started back about 1980, Mitch, when I was I found a woman who had a stalled car, stalled engine, and her hood was up, and I gave her a jump with my jumper cables. It was Christmas season in 1980, and I remember noticing two things. One was how relieved she was at having gotten back on the road, and the second thing was how good it made me feel. It was like I don't do drugs, but it must have been like doing drugs, because I felt a rush of pleasure just having done that. And so I said, well, I've got to do more of this. That was so cool. So I began looking for cars that were in distress, and I discovered pretty quickly that there were many reasons besides needing a jump that people break down. And so over time, I'm talking 25 years now, I began to acquire knowledge about how to diagnose problems and as well as how to fix them. I'm not a mechanic, but all my stuff is low-tech, simple. And I began acquiring tools one at a time, and so now I've got a trunk full of goodies that permit me to overcome almost anything that does not require a mechanic.
Do you think that, on the whole, cars are more reliable than they once were? I mean, if I understand correctly, you are driving a vintage Honda Accord to do this.
For sure, cars today are better than they used to be. They're just every facet to today's cars is more reliable than the old cars. And I'm not saying the solutions are easier, but because there's so many more things that are automated and electronically controlled and are automatic in function, there are. Cars are better. The tires are much better than they used to be. My car, I have two Hondas that I use. I have two Honda Accords. One is an 89 Honda Accord that now has 507,000 miles on it. I bought it new. And that car is broken down three times on me, and I was able to bail myself out each time. I have another. I have an 07 Accord that has no idea how far it's going to get driven before it's over with. But I swap out to keep them both fresh. I'll swap out about every 3 weeks. I take the new car on longer trips just for reliability reasons. But I love them both, and they're both super cars. I want to say one thing which is really kind of fundamental that folks ought to hear is to listen to your car. When I say listen, that's listen with quote marks. It will, quote-unquote, tell you when it's about to fail. Now, your job is to listen to the car and pay attention to things like wheel vibration, a mushy handling, or pulling to one side, all of which indicate a low tire. Weak engine starts, dim lights, and chirping of the gauges and stuff when you put the key in the ignition and try and start it, or weak headlights. That's an indication that your battery is about to go, or you have a weak connection between the battery and its clamps. Or the temperature gauge reads hot, or you have steam coming out of the exhaust pipe. That's white exhaust. That's not exhaust, that's steam, and that's a bad indicator. It indicates that it's a good indicator that you've got a bad problem, that you're getting coolant inside your engine, which is not too good. Or unusual noises from wheels, brakes, engine, transmission, or funny odors, or fluid leaks. These are things that your car is talking to you, and your car is saying, take me to the doctor before I fail on you, because I'm about to fail on you.
Well, these are all really important things to keep in mind. And Walt Brinker, I am really struck by what you get out of doing this, that it's not just personal satisfaction, but also the idea of making the world a better place.
Well, let's see, different strokes for different folks. Some people have different hobbies. Some folks go to the movies. Some play golf. I consider this to be like entertainment. You know, it costs me about $7 to get out on the highway and drive for about an hour. And I'll usually find on Interstate 95 near where I live, I can usually find one person each time I go out. So it's worth it.
Changing the world one tire at a time.
There it is.
All right. Walt Brinker, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Enjoyed it. And best of luck to you and your listeners.
Baby, break down. Go ahead, give it to me. Break down, honey, take me through the night.
Walt Brinker's book is called Roadside Survival, Low-Tech Solutions to Automobile Breakdowns. Brinker, who lives in North Carolina, performs free roadside assistance as a hobby. He's made over 2,000 assists. You'll find a link to more about the topics he talked about from WUWM.com. Too bad he doesn't make house calls here or road calls, I guess. Anyway, that's Monday's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North, off to check my tire pressure.
And I'm Mitch Tyke, installing some new wipers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.